So, welcome everybody to the afternoon session where I'm supposed to give a Dhamma talk. But according to how I was trained in Thailand, that sometimes on such occasions such as these, when there was a huge occasion, sometimes Ajahn Chah, he would look down the line of monks or nuns and he looked down the line and say, "Oh, Venerable, you will give a talk." He did that to me once. It was the second biggest day of the calendar in Thailand. It was a February full moon day. And thousands of people came to his monastery, Wat Pa Phong. Literally thousands. There was about 200 monks there as well. And usually you would expect that the great master Ajahn Chah would be the one who would give the talk. And he looked down the line of monks. And when he looked down the line, you knew that he had decided he is not going to give the talk that night. He is going to choose somebody else. And it could be anyone. Absolutely anyone, even a little novice. And because of your discipline, if he asked you to give a talk, you had no choice. You had to go up and give a talk. And he went right down the line of monks. I was towards the end. And when his eyes met mine, I shivered. And he went further down the line. Wow, I'd escaped. It was a lucky one, I thought. And then his eyes came up again. And oh my goodness, he stopped at me. "Come on, sir. Get up and give a talk." In Thai. In front of my teacher. About 2,000 or 3,000 people there. Ah! So, to keep traditions. No, I wouldn't do that to you. But it was actually showing you just how to overcome fear and how to overcome conceit as well, because that has nothing to do with the training as a Buddhist. In fact, just beforehand, that someone was asking me, "Do you really believe that on the Buddha's enlightenment, that on his birth, that when he took 7 steps, he said that I am the chief, the best in the world?" And that is according to our tradition. But it must mean there's something in that which doesn't ring true. And that is almost like the arrogance of saying that you are the best in the world. That part of Buddhism is something I can see these days, but which is also something which is really shouldn't have any part of being a Buddhist. Because I always remember one of the suttas where this monk came up to see the Buddha, and Ananda was with the Buddha as his attendant. And the monk said that one who is fully enlightened, who is an arahat, has actually reached the peak, never thinks they are better than anybody else, never thinks they are worse than anyone else, and never thinks they are the same as anybody else. And the Buddha says, "Yes, correct." And then when the monk left, the Buddha turned to Ananda and said, "That was an enlightened being, an arahat. That's how enlightened beings tell me of their attainments. They never think they're better than anybody else. Never think they're worse than anybody else. Not the same as anybody else." And at one stroke that gets away from this terrible thing we have in life of thinking we're inferior or thinking we're superior or thinking that everybody is the same. It's obvious we're not the same. I am much fatter than many of you. Some of you are better than me. So we're not all the same, but we're not better, we are not worse. And when we stop that pride and measuring who's the best, who's the worst, we get rid of a lot of the causes for disharmony in our world. Even these days, you know, you see religions fighting amongst each other. We are better than you. Or even within Buddhism, that this is the best tradition. Yes, I remember my predecessor, Ajahn Jakara, telling me this, that he went to an interfaith meeting. This was 30-odd years ago now here in Perth. And the Muslim fellow, he really made a lot of friends when he said, "It's just like our education system," said the Muslim fellow. He said, "You Jews are like primary school. You Christians are like secondary school. And we Muslims, we're like university." As far as Buddhists were concerned, we weren't even in kindergarten. But that is not the way to win friends. And instead, you know, we take away all this idea of superiority and inferiority. And then we don't have this terrible pride business. And even in Buddhism, we have some parts of Buddhism is better than other parts of Buddhism. My yana, my tradition is better than your tradition. This is a pure tradition. This is a meditation tradition. But even the Buddha said, monks, you should not compare yourself like that. No more than you compare, again, like children in primary school. Just because you're in grade one, does that mean that you're somehow inferior to the people in grade six? Just the people in grade six have been there longer, that's all. It doesn't make you inferior. And so the whole idea of conceit was one of the things which had no part of Buddhism from the very earliest of days. And that's one of the reasons why, as monks and nuns, we never tell anybody who's enlightened and who's not. Who's got the deep meditations and who's not. Who can levitate and who's not. Because if you have to levitate in public, you need to have a flying license, first of all. And we don't give out licenses to fly in public. So nuns, no flying this afternoon, okay? So the idea is not to show off and trying to be the best. And that means that there's a sense of like equality and just people actually working together. And you know, sometimes that when you go overseas or even here in Perth, sometimes people don't recognize who you are because you don't put yourself up in front. I still remember just over a year ago because someone was reminding me that every year they have a UN Day of Vaisak. A year ago, it was held in Vietnam. And at that sort of little conference, I was sitting there waiting for a presentation on one of the sessions, sitting there just like an ordinary monk. And another monk came up next to me. And he just started chatting like monks do. "Oh, where are you from?" said this Vietnamese monk. I said, "Oh, I'm from Australia." "Oh, you're from Australia," he said. He said, "Do you know a monk called Ajahn Brahm?" I said, "Yeah, I know him very well. I am Ajahn Brahm." Because he expected somehow or other that, you know, you to be somehow special and somehow sit in a front seat and somehow go on in limousines everywhere. You don't treat monks like royalty. When we are monks, we try and live simply. So every monk, every nun lives the same. And I try and pride myself on being the simplest. And also working with other people. So, you know, even with the ordinary stuff in the monasteries, always like to give a hand, even the dirty stuff. So I remember even once there wasn't many people helping out in the kitchen at Bodhinyana Monastery, so I decided to try and give a hand. The trouble is, you guys won't let me do that sort of stuff. I went into the kitchen to help wipe the dishes. And I remember this Thai lady, she never said anything. She just took the dish wiping cloth and pulled it off me. Saying, "Ajahn Brahm, we can do this. You go and teach the Dhamma or something." Or even a year ago, was doing some building over in Bodhinyana Monastery. No one was looking, so I could get on the roof and put on some roof sheets. I was having a wonderful time doing some building work. Until the caretaker took photographs and put them online. And then all these people said, "Ajahn Brahm, no, you're not allowed to do any work on top of roofs. You've gone past that stage now. Anyway, you're so heavy, you may cave in the roof." But, you know, it's nice to actually just try and be a simple monk as best you can. And not not have any of this idea of being better or being worse or being the same. Because once you have that, you know, Buddha called it the three conceits. I'm the best, I am the worst, I am the same. Then you get, you know, being the same is just denying the reality that everybody is different. Not better, not worse, just everyone has different qualities to them. And you don't judge. One is better than the other, one is equal to the other, or one is worse than the other. And it's the same whenever you think that someone is better than you. You get this terrible pride business. I'm the best. It reminds me of an old story which I told in Melbourne last week when I was teaching there. Of the four Catholic ladies having coffee one afternoon. And one of them said, "Oh, I'm so proud of my son. This weekend he became a Catholic priest. He's now a father. And all these young women, they really respect him." And the second woman, drinking her coffee, said, "That's nothing. That's absolutely nothing. My son became a priest a long time ago. Now he's a bishop. You know, when any women see him, they go down on one knee, kiss his ring and call him Your Grace." And the third woman said, "Nothing. That's absolutely nothing. My son is a cardinal." When a woman come in a room in front of him, they just go down on both knees and they kiss his ring and they call him Your Eminence. I'm so proud of him. And the fourth lady said, "That's nothing." Have a guess what her son was. She said, "My son never joined the clergy. He became a football player, professional football player. He now plays for the West Coast Eagles. He's 6'3", really rich and very beautiful. Whenever women come and see him, they fall on the floor and say, 'Oh my God, oh my God.'" That's an old joke, but it's a nice one. So all this conceit business, I'm better, the other one is worse. There's another of those little stories which I put in the Good, Bad, Who Knows book. And that is one about these doctors having a sort of a party, having a bit of reception. And this young guy comes up, you know, really up himself, very conceited. And he comes to the host, he said, "Hi, you know, thank you for inviting me to your doctor's party." And he said, to the host, "Now, what do you do in the medical profession?" And the host said, "I'm a GP. And I've been doing a GP work for years and years and years." And the visitor said, "Only a GP? That's nothing. That's nothing. I'm a brain surgeon," said this guy. "Being a GP is hardly brain surgery." So he asked his wife, he said, "What do you do?" And she said, "Oh, I do work for volunteer organizations overseas. Last time I worked for Medecins Sans Frontières in some of the places in the Middle East where there's all these refugees, where there's no doctors, bullets flying all over the place and bombs." And this young man said, "Yeah, I suppose someone has to do that, but it's not exactly like being a brain surgeon, is it? Brain surgery is much better." And then he met their son. He said, "Are you a doctor?" "Yeah, I'm a doctor too. What field of medicine are you in?" He said, "Oh, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a doctor of physics. I work for NASA. I'm a rocket scientist. Being a brain surgeon is hardly rocket science, is it?" So eventually, when you get into ego and I'm better than somebody else, you will always meet someone who's even better than you, which is one of the reasons why all this arrogance and ego business has got no place really in our world. It doesn't matter who's the better, because once you have someone being better, you always have people being worse. And that's what most people have in this world. We always think that we're not good enough. That's terrible. You go to a school and you start doing well. "Oh, at last I'm good enough." And then they take you and move you to a big school where you're really good in the little school becomes not good enough in a big school. So you work really hard and you really do well in a big school and they put you in a bigger school. Have you ever noticed it's just so hard to excel? If you excel in one thing, then you go to a higher level. And you keep on going up and up and up until eventually you have to fail. You're not good enough. That's one of the problems in the world, where we have excellence or the striving to excel is for some the meaning of life. To me, the striving to excel just causes more suffering. For me, it's the striving not to excel, but the striving to be not good in. To not excel, just to be yourself, which is one of the reasons why I came up with the phrase a long time ago, to lower your expectations of yourself. Not to strive to excel, but to strive to be average. The middle way. You don't need to be the best. In fact, those people who are the best have a lot of suffering. But if you're in the middle, average somewhere, then you are much happier. If you notice in the farm, it is the fattest pigs who get taken to the slaughterhouse first. Do not strive to excel. It is the big poppies who get cut down first of all. But those who go in the middle somewhere, that is the best place, the happiest place. So that's why I tell your children, you don't try and be the best, don't try and be the worst. Middle way, just be yourself. Or the same, women tell me this, women who are really beautiful have a terrible time. And they get, again, so conceited. I remember that, I told this again, I think in Melbourne. I went to one of these Buddhist groups in Sydney a few years ago, and this was in Double Bay, which is the really snooty area of Sydney, you know, where just all the TV stars and rich people and other people live in Double Bay. And while I was there, I was teaching a meditation day for a couple of hours, and there was this woman in the back who was looking at me and smiling and looking at me, and I just wondered what the heck she was up to. I was a bit concerned, but I just carried on teaching and doing my usual stuff. And at the end, she actually walked out in a huff. I'd really offended her. And I couldn't understand why. So I had to ask the organizer, what did I do wrong? And that woman, she just walked out. I said, didn't recognize her. That was some TV star. I think she said it was Lisa McCune or something, or someone like that. And I don't watch the TV. I didn't know who she was. But she knew who she was, and she was upset that I didn't. Just like the arrogance. You don't remember me? No. And that really upset her, because you're not used to that. That's the arrogance. Or like the time when I taught a meditation retreat, and there was a supermodel was on the retreat with me. So young guys, learn meditation, go on these retreats, and you come into contact with supermodels. We had a retreat here. We had a Thai supermodel. She was a film actress, sorry. In the old days, we had a retreat at North Perth, and a film actress from Thailand came on my retreat. And the reason I knew that is because for the first time in a long time, I saw all these young Thai men come on a 9-day meditation retreat. And I was asking, I never seen you here before. I didn't realize you were into meditation. And then I realized why. A Thai supermodel actress had come on to this retreat and they just wanted to be with them. But anyway, when this supermodel was on my retreat, she really, I was just in Kuala Lumpur, she got upset because of her arrogance. That at the end of the retreat, you know, when people started taking photographs, they all wanted photographs with me and no one wanted to take a photograph of her. And she got upset. So this is the trouble when you have arrogance and you think you are something. You really sort of get a lot of suffering that way. So instead of trying to be the best, which is a lot of suffering, you know, just be who you are. You don't have to be, don't ever think you're the worst either. Because whenever there is conceit of being the best, it'll always be the opposite of being the worst. So that's why when the Buddha said, I am the best, that doesn't make sense to me. He would have said, there's no one here to be the better, the worst, or anything. That's more like what the Buddha said. And so he could go to many, many places. And like it says, some places no one would recognize him. There's a couple of places where that happened. In one of the suttas, there was this monk. He had been ordained as a monk by one of the Buddha's disciples in the west of India, close to the coast. And after getting his training, he said he wanted to go and visit and see the Buddha. So his teacher gave permission, so he was walking all the way to the Ganges Valley to try and meet the Buddha. And so on the way, you'd sleep anywhere, and one of the places it seemed to be where monks would sleep was in like people's workshops. Next to their house, they'd have a little shed. Of course, at night time, they wouldn't be used. They'd only be used during the daytime when they were working. So he asked this, I think, Potter, can I stay in your shed overnight? Yeah, of course you can. So he stayed in the shed, and a little while later, another monk came. And the other monk also asked the Potter, can I stay in your shed too? He said, if it's okay with the other monk, fine. So the other monk agreed. So these two monks were sharing this old potter's shed one evening. And one of the monks started meditating, the other started meditating. And this young monk, on his way to see the Buddha, said, oh, this monk really meditates well, I better meditate well. And so the two of them were meditating and meditating and meditating. They meditated all night, the two of them. And in the early morning, when they came out of their meditation, the second monk said to this young monk, he said, oh, you really meditate well. Who's your teacher? And he said his teacher was a disciple of the Buddha himself, and he was on his way to visit the Buddha. And then this young monk asked this other monk, who's your teacher? And this other monk said, I haven't got a teacher. What do you mean you haven't got a teacher? I am the Buddha. Ah! And this monk had been meditating all night in the presence of the Buddha and never even knew it. So the Buddha actually did look like every other monk, and he wasn't just proud in the sense that, this was the Buddha. He didn't have like stars on his elbow or pips on there for rank, didn't have any special robe, and no one would really know exactly who he was. Now that is what I read in Buddhism, of being, when I'm sitting up here, I have to sit up on the stage so I can talk with you. But when you go in other places, you just disappear amongst the crowd. So no one knows who you really are. And that's the idea of like disappearing. No pride, no better, no worse, no the same. And that's what I get from what happens when you understand who you really are. Because sometimes you ask, who actually is better? Who is worse? How can you say that you are better than any other human being? And maybe you've had good fortune. How can you say you're worse than any other person? You may just have some bad karma you're going through. And who knows what might happen even next week. So we never actually have any idea. We try and discourage as much as possible thoughts of arrogance. And that's even why that, sometimes in my position I have to be self-deprecating. Because sometimes people were asking me, what is your title? And if you see the advertisement over there in the reception area of a gig I'm doing in Korea in July, 7 eminent meditation masters, and some have reminded me, they've described me as a supreme sage from Cambridge University. Ha ha ha, Stephen Hawking, eat your heart out. Well, they put this stuff up, supreme sage. So because of that, I've got to stop that rubbish. And so I keep telling people, if you want to know my real title, it's HR, Ajahn Brahm. You know what HR means? His roundness. And that is a swipe. It is a statement against all this holiness, your holiness, your eminence, your most venerable, your extreme venerable, your supreme extreme venerable. Which goes on and on. What's that got to do with Buddhism, for goodness sake? And all these titles which sometimes people give, like in Sri Lanka, Mahanayakas. They never had Mahanayakas in the time of the Buddha. Sangharajas, Chalkuns. I don't know what else they have, these titles, but we try and just, not have anything to do with those. I like it sometimes when you see the builders. They just call me Brahm. Hi, Brahm. How are you doing? Because Ajahn means teacher. So if I'm your teacher, fine, you can call Ajahn Brahm. But if you're just a friend, or if you're just a builder, they call Brahm. I quite like that. Because it's... But still remember with names. Years ago, going to teach at Mercedes College in East Perth. And I went to give like a presentation on Buddhism there. And it just happened the day afterwards, or 2 days afterwards, I was walking down St. George's Terrace, Adelaide Terrace, and some of the schoolgirls were walking down. And they stopped and say, hi. And I said, you remember me? He said, yeah, you came to our class 2 days ago. I said, I'm very, very touched you still remember me. And then he said, oh, we'll never forget you. Oh, that's very nice. How can you forget someone called Ajahn Brahm? I said, there's an M on the end, okay? It's not Ajahn Brahm, it's Ajahn Brahm. So these are schoolgirls having a bit of fun. So I enjoyed that, and it gave me another story to make other people laugh. But you try and get rid of all those conceited business. Otherwise, as a monk, you would never survive. You get above yourself. Sorry, as a monk never gets above himself. He gets above his no-self. No one really there. So, when we meditate, as Buddhists, we try not to have hierarchies. I've often mentioned that when you start having hierarchies, that's where a lot of problems begin. And the Buddha never asked for any hierarchies. On his enlightenment, he realized, how can you judge one set of body and mind with another set of body and mind? How can you compare them? It is literally like comparing, you know, apples and oranges. Is an apple better than an orange? People are so different that you cannot compare. You can't even say they're the same. And that's one of the beautiful things of understanding the nature of this body and mind. How can you say you're better or you're worse? And when you take that away, being better or being worse, when you stop the judging, then there's no reason for striving anymore. What are you striving for? To better yourself? Aren't you already good enough? And as long as you think that there is something to achieve, something to improve, you are going to be suffering, suffering, suffering. There is nothing to improve. Only to actually to see that, just to be. Stop trying to be better. That is conceit happening. That is ego. That's the sense of self happening. But unfortunately, our society always wants to improve this and improve that. That's why the society gets more crazy. Always trying to do things better, trying to improve things. And do we really improve? Anyone who's old enough, sometimes you look back to the good old days when there was no traffic jams. When kids could go and play on the streets at night perfectly safe. I remember my youth in the summer holidays in England where it was light about 4 o'clock and the sun never went down till about 8 or 9 in the summer. You know, you'd take some sandwiches and you'd say to your mum, I'm going out, and you wouldn't come back till, you know, after dinner time. She'd keep your dinner for you. You'd be out all day. You know, just perfectly safe. No one really worried. Because you'd always be well looked after. In fact, I was worried because, you know, everybody knew one another. So if you got into trouble, you know, your mum and dad would soon find out. Like in the old villages in Sri Lanka, you couldn't get into any mischief because everybody knew you and knew who your parents were. So you'd get in big trouble if you misbehaved. But, you know, you were nice and free and happy. And you didn't have any mobile phones during the talks to disturb you. Oh, those were beautiful days. Isn't this progress? But we always want to try and improve things. Honestly, have you improved your life? Or is it all the striving to improve which just made life more complicated? Sometimes it's true, isn't it? Just the striving just makes things more complex, more difficult. Just over a year ago, I had a very good glimpse into your lives. When one of our disciples here, he died, And he made me executor of his will. Please don't do that. He made me executor of his will because he trusted the monks. And so I had to look into all his affairs and sort of find out all of his stuff which he had. Now, fortunately, I had some good friends to help me out on this. But I couldn't believe how complicated a life could be. You know, just all this bit of money over here, assets there, and how much rubbish in a small apartment. And it was a very, very good insight for me to see how many people live. How over many years of life, life is just so complex. And an executive of a will, I had to untie all those threads and settle all the affairs. And it took over about a year to do all of that. Life is so complicated. And so, is that really an improvement? So sometimes I look at life and say, well, you know, here you are, this is good enough. Why not enjoy life instead of always trying to go up to the next level of arrogance and conceit and trying to be better? People, you know, when I teach in Singapore, they always want to get promotions and go to the next level in their companies, up the career ladder. And I look at them and said, you're crazy trying to get up the career ladder. What do you get if you get a promotion? More work. More stress. Haven't you got enough stress already? But we get more money. Yeah, but it still isn't enough. It's much better to be satisfied with the not enough money you have now than the not enough money you'll have when you get promoted. It's never enough, is it? Put your hands up now, anyone here who's got enough money. Great, now put the donation in the box right now. Got you. You can afford it, obviously, because you've got enough. I'm a very tricky monk. Yeah, but I know what you mean. You're content, it's good enough. What happens when you have this good enough, this contentment, not trying to excel, not trying to be the best? You have a much happier, more content life. And there's some people here, they get into trouble when they follow me because their parents or their friends say, you're not trying hard enough. You should excel. You've got great abilities. Go for the promotion. Try the next level. But honestly, why are you doing that? Isn't happiness the most important? We always try to find success in life, not realizing we have success for the taking. If we know how to be content, then we're always happy. And happiness is success. Sometimes people ask, what's the secret of success? Is it hard work? Is it struggling and striving, making a difference in this world? For some, but for most people, success in life is being happy. You're not judged by others. The only person whose judgment ever means anything, really, is yourself. If you're happy, well done. You're successful. As simple as that. And what do you need to be happy? You don't need the admiration of your colleagues. You don't need sort of other people to tell you, because you know yourself, happiness, contentment. And this is one of the great lessons of the Buddha, to let go of craving and to realize you have enough. Your body is good enough. Life is good enough. You have friends. The most simple things in the world are the cause of the highest happinesses. Sometimes I like to ask people, when was the happiest time of your life? And you think about that happiest time, you remember it, whenever it was. And it wasn't much happening there. It wasn't when you won a lotto or when your team won the final of the competition. A lot of times real happiness is just a day with your family, people you love and cared for. Maybe a time in your childhood where you felt so free and happy and just, you didn't need anything. Often notice that the happiest times in people's lives are noted by the times of very deep contentment. Times when you don't want anything else. Memories of a time when you were totally content with the people who were with you. You didn't need anybody else. You didn't want anybody else. You didn't want for anything. And sometimes those moments of happiness, you realize, are moments of very deep, strong contentment. And you realize the secret of happiness. Contentment. What do you need to be content? Here in Australia, we live in a very safe country. Very beautiful climate. There's enough food around. Is it easy enough to find a place to stay? You know, if you want a big mansion, then you have to work really hard. But that's really stupid, living in big mansions. Too much to clean. And of course, I keep saying, if you live in a big mansion, you never see the people you share the mansion with. It's too big. You get separated from the people you love. Small is beautiful. Small is easy to clean. Small is cheap. You don't have to work so hard. Small houses don't attract such burglars. They take one look at your old house and think there's nothing much in there. They go for the big mansions. Small cars are much better than the big cars. That's why Theravada, a small vehicle, it's always the best. Have you ever tried to find parking for big vehicles in the city? Small is beautiful. So small vehicles, small houses, old clothes. You don't need the latest fashions. Take the oldest fashions. This is the oldest fashion in the world. 2,500-600 years. And it is still popular. Hundreds of thousands of people wear these. So it's still fashionable after all these years. And I've really noticed, even a couple of Thai women this morning had the jeans with all the holes in them. Frayed jeans. That's Buddhist. That's the old Buddhist, you know, patchwork robes. And now you see that in women's jeans. We're way ahead of fashions. Bald heads. We've been wearing bald heads for 2,500 years. And now you see people shave their heads. It's fashionable. Even women shave their heads sometimes, and it's fashionable. But, you know, you have to do that because you're a nun. But, you know, even lay women. So we're way ahead of the game. And it's simple. It's great shaving your hair. He says, do it once a fortnight, that's all. And it doesn't cost anything. 5 minutes and it's all off. How long does it take to go to a hairdresser? How much does it cost? And how many chemicals do you have to put into that hair? And how much combing and brushing and blow drying and dyeing? I don't have to dye my hair. If you're afraid of your hair going grey, shave it off. Then no one knows. So it's simple, it's beautiful. And you can be content so easily in this world. And you realize contentment is happiness and happiness is success. And so people say, but Ajahn Brahm, if everyone believed like this, where will be the progress in this world? The progress comes from contentment when people are happy. When people realize that the simple things are the most important in life. They remember family ahead of their bank balances. They realize that, you know, their relationships are more important than their position in the company. They just change the priorities in this world. And it's not sort of the budget deficit. It's just how people get on with each other. The social deficit. Are we really spending on social programs and social cohesion and social health? For what? The happiness of a country is often measured by the way it treats its poor and disadvantaged and elderly and sick. Can't we actually rephrase, rejudge sort of what we're really about as a country? Not worry so much about our hip pocket, more worry about our heart pocket. what's in here rather than what's in our pockets in the side. If we can do that, we're learning a little bit more about what Buddhism is all about and how it can both change human beings, change ourselves, and not have competition anymore, have cooperation. Whenever we have better, worse, or the same, we'll always have competition. But when we have another way of looking at life, not better, not worse, not the same, then we have the idea of cooperation, where we can share with people. And sharing is much better than having it for yourself. So this is how we understand that just before the Buddha died, why he said, when somebody asked him, who will look after Buddhism just when you pass away? And at his final passing away, he said, he made the announcement, no one will be in charge of Buddhism when I pass away. There will be no leader, no pope, no Sangharaja, no Mahanayaka, no archbishops or bishops or head honchos. There'll just be the Dhamma Vinaya, that's all. That'll be your leader. And to me, that was one of the most profound sayings of the Buddha, which I think is one of the reasons why it kept Buddhism strong for so many centuries, why it could not be wiped out in this country or that country, because they always say, just you get the head of the snake and the rest of the snake dies. But there is no head of Buddhism. There is no leaders. The Dhamma Vinaya, that is, if anything, the leader, the teachings, the truth, that is the head of Buddhism, which means that it's always alive and vibrant, it's always innovative, surprisingly, because no one can stop it. There is no boss to control Buddhism. It's just like a forest where many trees grow. Some trees do well, some trees don't do well. There's no just overarching tree master or dictator of all trees decides which one will grow and where it will grow. It grows according to cause and effect, natural principles. So if a community of monks or nuns are doing the right thing, then it will grow. If it don't, it won't grow. It's not controlled by some superior being. It's this beautiful natural growth, the natural prosperity of Buddhism. And because there's no boss, that again is just saying there's no one who's better, no one who's worse, no one who's the same. But for your surprise, even though I've been here for such a long time, even though I was here at the very, almost at the beginning, just when we just had a very, very, very small house in North Perth, and I remember just looking at the accounts when I first came here 32 years ago, and the house was worth $50,000. We had $49,000 as a mortgage. You know, and Lynn, you were there at the time. And I remember when we started Bodhinyana Monastery, I just went to the shop. It was actually Bones. Remember Bones? Bones shop. To get a battery drill. Because we were building a monastery and a battery drill cost $50. And I got that out of our accounts and the person who took me there to pay for it took me aside afterwards and said, Ajahn Brahm, $50 is a lot of money. Please use that drill carefully. And it was. And I always remember that, reminding me that we can't waste things. So that's where you start off from. And you start off because it was a good place, good community. We've grown. We've done very well over those years. Naturally, but there's no person telling you what to do. And that no boss is an important message which I like to give you as well. That whatever I say, just don't just believe me because I say it. In some communities, that sometimes if a monk says something, they say, wow, he's holy monk. He can't make any mistakes. Whatever he says, I must do. And you get into big trouble. In our monastery in England, the nuns, I love telling the story. The nuns were going to the airport from the monastery. So the head nun was in the passenger seat and a woman was driving. And the head nun was giving instructions. And so she told the driver, go straight ahead at the roundabout. And that's exactly what the driver did. Went straight ahead. Never went round it. Went straight ahead, right over the top, down the bank and round the other side. Well, that's what you told me to do. You're a holy nun. I thought there was some reason for that. Some people are really so stupid sometimes. The monk says something and then everybody must do it. No, no. Always remember, you never leave your brain outside the temple. Bring it inside. When you're in a car, just because you're with a monk, don't just think, oh, the monk is all-knowing, omniscient, so whatever he said, he must see something I don't see and just go straight. That's why these days I tell people, straight ahead of the lights. I never say that anymore. I say, straight ahead of the lights when they're green. To tell the driver. So anyway, there's no boss in Buddhism. Is there a boss in your family? Who is the boss person in your family? There should be no boss in a family, just like there's no boss in Buddhism. Husband, wife work together. They cooperate. In monastery, who is the boss? Honestly, that I am not the boss. The Sangha is the boss. The community. They make the decisions. And I have to live with them. So we always have discussions. And the majority always wins. Who is the boss in the nuns' monastery? Not Hasapanya. The whole community. Otherwise they gang up on her. They've been ganging up on you yet? Oh, yeah. Have to listen to them. Even she can't get her own way. And even our Buddhist Society of West Australia. I know Don, some years ago, my official title is spiritual director, and I really respect him. He's a really good joker. He said, Ajahn Brahm, you're really the spiritual dictator of the BSWA, not spiritual director. But that's not true. So everyone, all of their ideas, all of their commitments, contributions, are all respected, all put in the mix and see what comes out at the end. That's why even our president, the current president of the Buddhist Society, where is she sitting? She's not sitting in the front in the president's chair, she's right there in the back, in the corner, just disappearing, which is excellent. That's what Buddhists are supposed to do. So we don't hold ourselves special. We try not to have big egos. We try to lessen our conceit. We are nothing special. And if we can remember that, exactly, then you see, even I have to submit to a young child. Even I can't. You can't stop that. That's what children do. So when you understand that, you understand how the Buddha taught. Just no hierarchies. No someone being better than others. Not an old monk being more important than a child. When you understand that, you understand a beautiful part of Buddhism. Which sometimes people do forget. And please, never put any monk or any nun on a big pedestal. Just like the Buddha said, Buddhas can only show the ways. It's up for you to be able to walk that path. To walk that path and see for yourself. Monks, nuns, we can give suggestions to you. We can talk about the Dharma. We can share our insights and understandings and experiences of practicing this path for such a long time. We can inspire you, but we will never tell you what to do. And whatever you do here, you'll always be respected. Even kids, totally respected. No, leave her in here. Oh, I think she wants to go toilet. If she wants to go toilet, please don't leave her in here. So, which means that we can learn how to respect each other, have a harmonious society, to get away with this ego business and conceit business, trying to be better than other people, And then we may also get rid of this, I am worse than other people, I am not good enough, I am a failure, which is also part of the conceit business. And where we can get rid of the conceit, arrogance and success as being people on the front covers of magazines, people are the millionaires, people are the people who have arrived. You have arrived. Every one of you has arrived. You're here. And this is good enough. So if you understand that, you understand just how, through conceit, we cause so much problems. Even the lack of self-worth which people have these days. You are all good enough. The whole idea of being good enough is learning how to be content. And when you're content, you know happiness. When you know happiness, you understand the meaning of success. Success is the realization after all these years that all this striving and struggling has mostly been in vain. You are good enough. You are beautiful like the tree in the forest, crooked, bent, all over the place, wounded, scarred, damaged. You belong. Welcome. You are good enough. Thank you. Thank you. So, some questions about this little impromptu talk. Anyone from Perth, first of all? Because all these people overseas ask questions. And people here don't have a chance. There's one person sitting to my left over here. He admitted the only way he'd get a question asked, he got on his smartphone, he typed out a question, he sent it and said it was from Indonesia. And it went all the way over there and to here. And then I answered the question. We're just sitting over there. Really smart. So anyone here wants to ask a question, first of all? Okay, let's see what we've got from overseas. Because all these things are live streamed. Yes. Da-da-da. Who have we got from today? We've got three from the Maldives again. That was yesterday's. Okay. And Hawaii. Wow, we get questions from some of the most beautiful parts of the world, from Hawaii and the Maldives. Okay, from the question yesterday, I questioned about migraine yesterday during meditation session. I'm happy it worked. Wow. I could see blur light in front of my forehead. What should I do after that? It's worked so far. Whatever worked, that's good enough. Why do you want something more? This is the problem. Why we get migraines and suffering. We always want something more. See if you can be content with what you have. And then when you're content with what you have, then you advance in the Dhamma. When you want something more, then you go backwards in the Dhamma. As the saying goes, one of my favorite sayings, because it encapsulates the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, the essence of Buddhism, you might call this, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. Whenever you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So, if it's worked, wonderful. Enjoy. Don't want anything more. And then you find it even gets better. In Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka now, many Buddhist people, misleading people, saying some monks are arahat. What should we do in a situation like this? People explain from poor Sinhala people. How can we identify an arahat, fully enlightened? Anyone who says they're an arahat, you know they're not. Straight away. Already said this, because this is it, and this is like what somebody called some years ago spiritual materialism. Just like we have materialism. I'm better than you because I live in a bigger house. I'm better than you because I have a new car. I have a Porsche. I have a Ferrari. I have a Lamborghini. What have you got? That's spiritual materialism. I earn more than you earn. Doesn't that really? That sucks. That's nasty stuff. You don't judge a person you know, it's better because they've got more. So the same now, we have that in spirituality. Where are you? Are you a stream winner? Nah, that's nothing. I was a stream winner a year ago. I am now an anagami. Anagami, that's nothing. I'm an arahat. Arahat, that's nothing. When you're an arahat, if you're according to the Mahayana, you can go further and become a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva, that's nothing. Have you ever heard that sort of rubbish? And someone who really is enlightened never thinks they're better or worse than anybody else. That's why they usually keep things quiet. You never know who's an arahat, even if they're staring you in the face. Is this story in the time of the Buddha, of this young novice, Sumana the novice. He was just a little novice, and the monks would sometimes tease little novices, you know, asking to do this and do that, and tell them off when they didn't do it the right way. And one day on alms round, the Buddha saw one of the monks, they just knocked the little novice on the head, you know, just teasing the little novice. And the Buddha called all the monks together and he said, "You don't know who that novice is. That novice is an arahat with incredibly strong psychic powers." He said, "Because real arahats never tell who they are. People with psychic powers never tell you what they have, because they realize that their arrogance is not part of being a Buddhist." And that is where the Buddha actually said the simile of the four small things you should be afraid of. Now, the small snake can still pack a venomous bite and kill you. The small fire, and we know this living in forests in Western Australia, a tiny fire can create a huge bushfire which can destroy hundreds of homes and kill lives. All start from a tiny fire. And he said a small prince in those days, royal families had all the power. A small prince, you upset them later on when they become king and have power, they can take their revenge on you. And the last of the small things you should be careful of is small monks, little novices, because you don't know. Just because they've only just ordained, they'd be way, way ahead of a monk like me who's been a monk for such a long time. Who knows? And because of that, this means you don't know who is enlightened, who is not. But it is true that I think I told this in Sri Lanka. I think I told this once to you because I got this from California. A Sri Lankan man in California told me that in Sri Lanka, there's lots of people giving enlightenment certificates to people. Did I tell this story here just a week ago? Was it last Friday or a week ago, 2 weeks ago? When did I tell this story? A month ago. Okay, so some of you may have forgotten it, I hope. But this is what was happening in Sri Lanka. They were giving enlightenment certificates out to people. You're a stream winner, you're a once returner. And in one of these groups, they would have a retreat, a two-week retreat. And at the end of the retreat, they give you an exam. That's meditation and study. They give an exam, and on the basis of the result of the exam, they would give you a certificate, whether you're a stream winner, once returner, non-returner, or fully enlightened, the four stages of enlightenment. They give certificates out. And there was this old lady from some countryside in Sri Lanka, from a poor village. She was a very devout Buddhist. So when she came to Colombo to visit her relations, they thought as a treat they would sponsor her to this retreat. And so she was willing to go there. And after 2 weeks of meditation and study, they gave this old lady the examination. And with great joy, they gave to her a certificate of being a Sotapanna, a Soan certificate. They said, "Well done. As a result of this retreat, we can proudly declare that you are a stream winner." And she was very upset. She was very angry. She started scolding these people, and they couldn't understand why. "Why are you upset? You've got to the first stage of enlightenment. That's huge. That's massive. You should be so overjoyed. You're a stream winner now." And she told him, "You don't remember me, do you? I was here last year, and you told me I was a non-returner. Now you've demoted me." That's why I'm upset. And that place closed down afterwards. So, how can you identify an arahat? You can't identify an arahat. You can identify who is not an arahat. People who mess around, misbehave, arrogant, shout at you, get angry, get afraid. That's not an arahat. But identify who is very difficult. Lastly, from Hawaii, "I observe 8 precepts on Saturday. Would it be advisable to bring my son to the forest path to encourage appreciation of nature? I would like to instill that same appreciation in him, especially on Upasana Day." Excellent. That's one of the reasons why the monks and nuns, we try and build our monasteries in this tradition, in the forest, in nature. It's just so peaceful and so full of insight, you know, in the forest. You can see even just that simile I gave of the trees in the forest. They're all crooked, and they're all beautiful. The crooked, damaged ones are the most beautiful. They are good enough. Imagine the tree feeling, "I'm so terrible, so upset that the tree is not straight like a tree should be." Do you think a tree ever thinks like that? Do you think you have tree psychologists? The one tree gets really suicidal and decides to fall over. No, the trees are bent and crooked. That's what they're supposed to be. And it's the tree. If you go into the forest, you get your favorite trees in the forest. And they are the crooked ones, the bent ones. They've got really character. Just like you. The ones who've been really through the mill. The damaged goods who come to this temple. You are the most beautiful. You're the ones I love the most. The straight ones. Successful. No problems at all. Is that really beautiful? You've just got no character. Just, you know, just ordinary. But the ones who've been through the mill. All sorts of problems and difficulties and troubles. And you've gone through. You survived. Bent, crooked, but full of lovely leaves. Yeah, you're the best. So it's great to take your son in Hawaii to the forest parks and encourage appreciation of nature. There's a lot of Dharma to be found in nature. Just the way that nature just survives. And just is. Why trees grow. If it's a good place, it grows. If it's not a good place, it doesn't grow. But there's no control in nature. There's no great being who decides which trees grow and when a tree should die. Totally natural, totally free. Well, I think one of the reasons why nature is so powerful, we know we can't control it. Earthquakes, volcanoes, seeing the great ocean. No one can control that. That's why it gives us a sense of peace and freedom. Anyway, that's what I think anyway. So, thank you from overseas. Any questions here? Going? Okay. Yes.
Ajahn, it's about that little bodhisattva walking and saying that I was the greatest. But probably he was conceited still at that time because he was not enlightened. He was, he could walk and he could talk, and then being conceited, because even though he may have been a non-returner, anagami, but still he had the conceit. So he probably thought, I better let the world know.
No, because I remember the other person who used to say I'm the greatest was Muhammad Ali. So I don't think we could put the Buddha in the same category as Muhammad Ali. Because I actually met him when I was a kid. I was only 10 years of age, and he was fighting. I've got a great memory for old age. He was fighting this English boxer, Henry Cooper. I was only 10 years of age. It was school holidays. My dad said that someone said to him that he was training in this place called the White City in Shepherd's Bush. So me and my mate, we went around Shepherd's Bush, hanging around there all day until these African Americans came, about a dozen of them. We said, "Hey, sir, any of you, Cassius Clay in those days, any of you Cassius Clay?" He said, "Oh, yeah, he is." "Oh, great, sir. Can we have your autograph, please?" And he was just so nice, Muhammad Ali. He just signed an autograph and he said, "Do you kids want to come and watch me spar?" So he went into the ring and saw Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali spar. It was really good fun. He's just a nice guy. But But he always used to say, I am the greatest. And so when I saw that's what the Buddha was supposed to say when, you know, he was born, I thought, no, that can't be it. That's a totally different character, I think. But even if he was a non-returnee, you know enough about the Dharma not to say things like that. Anyway, that's my thing.